produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 423. What do they do next? Part 11b, Jeff Downes.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 423 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later. You can always get involved, please do, with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, amongst the coronavirus mayhem, Mark and I keep calm and listen to Adventures in Modern Recording by Buggles, in our second look at what Jeff Downes did next after leaving Yes following the end of the drama tour. We also have a twopence based around some alternatives to the live Yes shows, which have had to be cancelled or postponed. Before all that, though, a few updates from around the interwebs. In the Patreon group this week, we've had even more posts in our discussion about the Album of the Month, Union, and our top secret project is well underway, although we do need a lot more contributions. If you find yourself at a loose end, and you are already a patron, please do help in that effort. And if you aren't a patron yet, head over to patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details. On the YMP Facebook page this week, the company looking after Chris Squire's basses, Brindley's Music Centre, has been posting some wonderful photos of them. They've got the iconic Rickenbacker 4001S, the green one with the initial CS on it, and the triple-necked one. Sadly for us, they're not on display. Maybe one day. Paul Watson added some wonderful photos of The Sin at the Marquee, featuring Squire and Peter Banks. And Miguel Falcao has produced a YouTube announcement for Play for Chris 6, which is going to be a collaborative effort this year. Everyone is going to be playing The Fish. It's going to be amazing. Keith Hoisington spotted the fact that Songs from Songus, the 35th anniversary concert, is coming out as a 4LP set. And Nick Smith found an announcement in German that the Yes Swiss concerts on the Relay Air Tour have been cancelled. This was followed up by an official announcement from Yes themselves that all of the UK and European dates are now off. I do hope they'll be able to be rescheduled. Daniel Crone posted an interesting idea which takes our own twopence a lot further, so do go and take a look at that. And Dave Watkinson showed off the paperback edition of his Warriors book. He's coming on the show next week to talk about that and the release of his John Anderson and the Warriors EP. In the visitor posts, Doug Curran wished Billy Sherwood a happy birthday. He's 55. And Andrew Bell's progressive alternative show features some of the Cross and Banks album Crossover, which we spoke to David about some weeks ago. Jeffrey Mason spotted a Close to the Edge karaoke YouTube video. And yes, you're right, it's terrible. But in a very funny way. Stephen Lamb is the publisher of Dave Watkinson's Warriors book, and he also posted the cover of the forthcoming tome, while Jeffrey was back with a restored video of Steve Howe's Beginnings, featuring Patrick Mraz, Yes's 2004 live version of Long Distance Runaround, and the huge solo box set from Trevor Rabin called Changes. Doug Curran shared the front cover of the latest edition of Prog magazine, which has a lot of Yes and Roger Dean in it, and there were all sorts of things on Twitter which I'll have to let you discover for yourselves, including a troop of water diviners. As always, thank you very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch this week, including last week's commenters, Miguel Falcao, Ken Fuller, Doug Curran, and Terry Sadler.
Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.
I've heard some people saying that Adventures in Modern Recording is in some ways drama too, so I'm fascinated to hear why that might be. On the original record, there were 9 songs on which Jeff Downes contributed the following: keyboards on tracks 2 to 4 and 7, drum programming on track 7, production, tracks 3 to 4, 7 and 12. However, With Trevor Horn present on all tracks, it gives us the chance to listen to the whole thing and see what transpires. The album begins with the title track, Adventures in Modern Recording, which, as I mentioned to Mark last week, is one of my favourite titles of all time. It's a Horn, Darlow, Woolley composition, and it begins with crowd noise in a rather halfway through release-release manner, and what sounds like an arena rock band recalling Pink Floyd's The Wall crossed with Asia. When Horn brings in the main vocals, though, we morph into pure 80s synth pop, complete with synth drums and a chorus of the title, which owes a lot to Video Killed the Radio Star. And why not? It's a lot of fun and a wonderful game to spot the foreshadowing of lots of Horn trademarks, including vamping dollar keys and 90125 style arrangement. A fabulous overture to the album, which screams to the end fade out. The second song, Beatnik, a great musical pun, opens with some brilliant layered harmony vocals, which seem to blend a folky feel with the Yes choir. Acoustic guitars join in before a sudden blast of bass and drums, which could almost be an outtake from a drama session. It doesn't continue like that, however, and the groove setup is much more poppy, but it's already a deeply compelling piece of music. The lead vocals are steeped in reverb, presumably. This is Horn himself. The chorus features repeated cries of I was a beatnik, and it's great fun, quirky stuff, with a little bit of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and then a dreamy counterpassage with overtones of Beatles or Tears for Fears. A deceptively simple song, but with definitely left-field components thrown in, such as a weird and wonderful synth solo, all underpinned by a relentless and attractive bass line, which is a constant walking thread. It's amazing stuff. Next comes the Downs and Horn-penned Vermilion Sands, another eccentric and tantalising title. It's pure 80s fare, complete with highly recognisable Downs piano and synth lines. You can clearly hear Jeff's Fly From Here approach underneath a very unusual set of Horn vocals. Fretless sounding bass is blended in and contrasting sections are thrown together in a remarkable way. As Horn said, this is another one which doesn't sound at all like a single, particularly as after just over 2 minutes, we get a whip-lap change to a pseudo-jazz trumpet and bass passage, which spirals out of key before the original material returns. If you like Jeff's DBA material, this will definitely appeal as well. The definition of quirky, it continues to throw the listener off the scent by introducing more and more odd touches. The chorus is a point of return, though, which itself is a catchy tune, but as soon as you're happy with that groove, Horn adds car noises, honky-tonk piano, or door opening and closing sound effects. Next, a bit more synth jazz against a running bass pattern, which turns into a bit of a big band romp. At 6 minutes and 48 seconds, this is the mini progressive epic of the album, but I think it would take quite a few listens to appreciate its eclecticism and seemingly random changes. However, I'm certainly willing to try, as I think the soundscape will prove to be engrossing when a little more familiar. I wonder what will come next. Well, it's a song called I Am a Camera. No prizes for guessing the genesis of this one. Jeff Downs, Trevor Horn, and probably more of the band played a mashup called The Man in the White Car Suite in concert in 1980. It combined the drama song with other material and Video Killed the Radio Star in a somewhat controversial move for some less than appreciative die-hard Yes fans. I think it's a fabulous combination myself, and I can't see why Downs couldn't add his own compositions into a Yes concert when that's exactly what Wakeman and Howe had always done themselves. But back to this version of the drama song, I'm a Camera. Horn counts in, and the opening passages are much like the Yes version. Great Downs piano and high-pitched Horn vocals. However, instead of White, Howe and Squire entering, we have an 80s beatbox. I like Horn's bass playing here. It's not Squire, but it's still really good. The reworking of the song makes it into more of a substantial piece. Additions include some wordless chorus passages and some rearrangement of the original structure. The iconic vocoder voice is still present, as are plenty of your other favourite aspects, but this is more of a 12-inch remix of the material with a false ending and then a coda which reprises some of the material. It shows off Trevor Horn's growing arrangement talent, but maybe it does feel a little bit like a drawn-out version, more at home on an 80s 12-inch record. I still like it, though. On TV is an 8-bit fiesta, lasting 2 minutes and 45 seconds. This was the cutting edge of pop, full of synthetic beats and effects. It's huge fun, and because it's Trevor Horn, it has multiple techniques smashed together to create an era-defining work. The age of plastic, but also the age of the drum machine, MTV, and the home computer. This could easily be the soundtrack to a Tron, Kraftwerk, Gary Numan computerized movie, and I love it. Inner City initially sounds like a parody of 80s drum machines. The tom sound is comical, and I'm half hoping this is an intentional swipe at the technology of the day. The lyrics are a bit banal, but Horn performs them as well as usual. There's good contrast between verse and chorus with a bridge or two thrown in, and the inner city is effectively portrayed with striking keyboard chords and an expansive feeling. But the ostinato drums get a bit off-putting for me, a bit too Bon Tempi organ pattern. Dare I say, a bit of an album filler song. Well, I just did. Lenny is a Horn Downs co-composition. It's got cowbell in it. Could it do with more cowbell? I'm not sure. It's got people shouting Lenny. It's got dramatic bursts of rhythmical keyboard chords. It's got a pleasing vocal melody over the top. And it's got some well-constructed vocal harmonies. It does eventually get going, but it's a bit fragmentary. There's plenty of Downs characteristic keyboard work to enjoy, and the more continuous sections work really well. It gets a lot more interesting as it goes on, and taking it as a whole, you suddenly realise that its journey is actually an interesting one, and it makes me want to listen again. Horn sings higher than I've ever heard elsewhere at one point, which is a little off-putting if you're not expecting it, but overall, an enjoyable song. Rainbow Warrior is the final substantial song on the album. It starts in contemplative mode, with some quiet washes of synth and guitar. Horn sings above this until a sudden change of tone, as a complete band stomps in with disjointed chords on the beat. There's an actual grungy guitar in this mix, along with the ubiquitous Simmons drum synth toms. The lyrics and vocals give it all a sense of anticipation. Waiting for the Rainbow Warrior is repeated many times. In a first for the album, I think, there's a proper electric guitar solo here, which is a tiny bit Gilmore-esque, before we return to the quiet, tender mood broken by more synth drums, more guitar soloing, and the vocal refrain. Another interesting construction, it fades away while still in full flow. Finally, we have a reprise of the opening title track, Adventures in Modern Recording. There are lots of sonic techniques on show in this tiny fragment, which rounds off the album in fine style. So, overall, I think there's plenty to enjoy here. I do agree with Horn that this is much less of a hit catalogue of a record than The Age of Plastic. It does feel like it's been used as a vehicle for testing out techniques and approaches, and I think as such it's very successful. And a wonderful piece of the historical puzzle on Trevor Horn's journey to the pinnacle of pop production. A most rewarding listen.
Greetings, friends. So this week we're back with part two of What Did They Do Next with Mr. Jeff Downs. Now, before we get started on this, I just wanted to send out some best wishes to everybody out there. This is a very crazy time right now in the world. Lots of people are worried. Lots of people are nervous about what's going to be happening. I think the best thing we can all do is to kind of lean on each other for support. Maybe a little bit of direction here and there if people are unsure of what to do in these circumstances. For a lot of people, this is a new thing, obviously, but sometimes listening to a friend or chatting with somebody online might be just the medicine that we need to bring us back down to earth and not so stressed out. And hopefully our podcasts that me and Kevin do can do a little bit of the same for you. Take away some of those worries that you have during the day and escape for 20 minutes or, you know, 45 minutes or... Geez, I think we've even done maybe a close to an hour episode. You know, go back in the vaults and search out some of them and take yourself away from the worries for a little while. But now let's get back to this week's topic, and that's Mr. Jeff Downs and what he did after leaving Yes, when the drama tour was complete. And that would be the next Buggles album, which was Adventures in Modern Recording. Now, this came directly from Jeff himself, as Kevin put a post up on Twitter, I believe, asking what he did after he left. Yes. And he confirmed that it was, in fact, the Buggles record. So, once again, as usual, I'm going to give you my sort of insight on what I think of the record, and Kevin, I'm sure, will do a spectacular job in giving much more detail about the songs themselves. So what do I think of this record? Well, compared to The Age of Plastic, I don't think it's as strong as far as commercial hits, obviously. But to me, that doesn't necessarily make it a bad record. In fact, there's a lot of stuff on here that I found enjoyable, and in sort of the great tradition that is the Trevor Horn production, it's still a record that doesn't sound very dated to me. I mean, sure, there's a lot of drum machine and there's a lot of keyboards and, you know, keyboards that these days would be considered, you know, vintage keyboards. But still, Trevor has a way of making albums sound dateless, if you know what I mean. So what is it that Jeff Downes did on this record? According to Trevor Horn, Jeff appears very little on this record compared to the last one. He does appear on a few songs, which are, I believe, Beatnik, Vermilion Sands, I Am a Camera, and I believe there was one more where he did the drum programming with Lenny, I believe the song is called. Well, listening to the full record, to me it becomes perfectly apparent that Jeff is not on here as much as the last record. What gives me that idea, even without knowing about it from Trevor Horn's own words? Well, you just have to listen to the first couple of songs. Adventures in Modern Recording, for example. While it's a very catchy song, it has a great chorus, some fantastic sampling in here that he's done, but there's a lot of things here that are sort of missing that Jeff Downes usually contributes. Before I say what that is, I'll go on to the next song, which is Beatnik. Now, while he did play on Beatnik, it just doesn't seem like he had as much input on this song performance-wise because, again, it doesn't have those kind of characteristics of his playing. Now, Oliver Wakeman once made a point when he was talking about learning other keyboard players that were in Yes, their style of music, that Jeff Downes was a very rhythmical player, very much based around chords, and he wasn't so much a lead style player like his father, Rick Wakeman, was, but very much based around chords and rhythmical playing of the chords. Now, that's one thing that's very much missing in the songs that he doesn't appear on. Now, one of the first songs that he does appear on, which is Vermilion Sands, just screams Jeff Downes, in my opinion. The piano sound that's on there is very Jeff Downes. The sound of his piano is very much Jeff Downes, that sort of reverb sound that he has on his piano. The playing style that he has, again, with that, you know, sort of jaunty sort of chord playing, the left and right hand back and forth that he likes to do on the piano. It's very evident on here, as is his piano playing on I Am a Camera. Now, we have heard this song before, obviously, on the Yes album Drama, but I found it interesting to hear this version because I was curious to hear how much of this version appeared in the Yes one. Now, obviously, the piano parts are Jeff, and they appeared on the Yes version, and the vocoder stuff that appeared on here was also used in the Yes stuff. Now, a vocoder was something that Yes never really used before that point, I'm very sure. So that's obviously a contribution of Jeff Downes. Now, while the piano and the vocoder are very much taken from this version, the drums and bass guitar are not taken from this version. While they're not bad performances, I mean, Alan White's drumming is far superior to any drum machine, in my opinion. And while Trevor Horn is a fantastic bass player, his sort of bass playing is very different to Chris Squire, as we know, and it's just very evident that it's not, you know, the same caliber of playing, in my opinion. And of course, the main thing that's missing from this version that's on the Yes one is Steve Howe's fantastic guitar playing. Now, getting back to Jeff's keyboard playing, the song Lenny, he is credited for doing the drum machine parts on that. Now, while I think the drum machine is a very strong part of the song, I don't really know too much about his history of drum programming to really say, wow, that's, you know, that's Jeff Downes' style of drum programming. But if that's his contribution to the song, it definitely is one of the more memorable parts of it. He definitely knows how to make a drum beat catchy, starting with the cowbell at the beginning. He has some interesting lines with the snare drums at the end of the song. They're kind of repetitive at the end. They're just very catchy rhythms that help move the song along. Now, overall, I think the record is good. Do I think it would have been better if there was more Jeff Downes on it? Well, yeah, obviously, because his piano playing and keyboard playing is really what made the first album so strong, in my opinion. So while this is not an album that I would say to ignore, I don't think it's as strong as Age of Plastic. But, you know, if you're a completist, I would say go get this record. It has some great singing on it. The production is very good. And, you know, the songwriting is fine as well. Does it have as many commercial hits? No. But is that such a bad thing? No, not always. Sometimes I grow tired when I listen to some of my favorite bands, when I hear the, you know, the popular hits on there, because you've heard them so many times. It's sometimes nice to hear songs that are not so worn out on radio. That's my thoughts on The Adventures of Modern Recording. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about it a little bit more.
In these strange times we find ourselves, at least we've got the YMP to fall back on. And Mark's here with me now. How are you, Mark?
Very good, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Holding up okay in these very, very strange times, as I say. But let's talk about what Jeff Downs did next. And it's fascinating. You said in your piece that, of course, we're talking about what Jeff Downs did next, but he seems to have had less of an influence and less of a part in this album than I was imagining he might have.
Yeah. I kind of suspected that he would have a little bit more involvement than he did. But, you know, I guess when a big shining offer comes from a major record label, I guess it's difficult to say no.
Yes, that's right. I did listen back to Age of Plastic as well a bit today, and it does sound very much more like a collaboration than this record. And, you know, even on the Wikipedia article, it says that this is very much a Trevor Horn solo album, really. So it's quite strange, but it does give us the chance to talk about these two alumni at the same time, Downs and Horn. And yeah, I mean, I think I was in agreement generally with what most people have said about this. It is a bit more left field, Adventures in Modern Recording. Left field, as he said, a bit more experimental. And is that how it felt to you generally?
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely tell that Jeff's involvement is not as strong in this. One thing that I think you probably mentioned, I think it was in your piece, that I found really, really interesting was that I think you mentioned something about the fact that even though he knew this album wasn't exactly going to be a big hit, it's almost like he used the album as an excuse to experiment with different things.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It almost seemed like he was trying to work out some things for future use. And I kind of got that vibe as well, because it almost seemed like in some songs he kind of would have experimented a little bit more on some songs than he would have if he knew he had like bona fide like hit singles.
Mm. Yeah, and as such, I think it is very interesting and a really interesting listen. And I would recommend, as you did in your piece, that everyone goes and has a listen to this. One of the aspects of it which I'm not sure about is those synth drums. I suppose they're in a better place than something like ABWH with Bill Bruford's snare drum, which sounds like a machine gun. In this one, the thing which put me off really was the tom sound. It's a weird sort of anomaly of the 80s, isn't it? This sort of boinging sound that they use, and he uses it quite a bit in this. Did any of those 80s aspects annoy you?
Yeah, mainly because I was never big on drum machines to begin with. I mean, even as a songwriter, I kind of loathe the early drum machines, the Alesis HR16, which I had back in the day, yeah, which sounded nothing like a drum set. I mean, at one point they had an upgrade for it where you had a sort of better sounding snare drum. They called it the wood snare. And all of a sudden, yeah, it was like, okay, this sounds a little bit better now. But, you know, the problem was that the technology back then was still kind of catching up, you know, with, yeah, you know, with how things were. And, you know, it's just very much a part of the time. I mean, what I kind of think about is that when I listen to it, is that even though they were electric drums, like a drum machine being used, it's incredible how much Trevor Horn can make them sound at least bearable in some instances.
Yes.
Like he knows how to EQ them and how to process them to make them sound at least, you know, you're able to listen to a 4-minute song without ripping your hair out.
Yes, absolutely right. He does do an amazing job on that. I do remember going to Musical Exchanges, which was the big band equipment shop in Birmingham here, in about 1980, I suppose it would have been 83, 82. And I was having drum lessons at the time on a Saturday morning with my amazing drum teacher, whose name was Tim Bragg, which is a fantastic rock name. And we went up there to try and find some cymbals and things. But I also asked them when I was there, did they have any secondhand drum machines? Not because I wanted a drum machine, but because I wanted to understand the technology and how you program them and so on, and use it in the music centre that I went to. And I remember distinctly the guy saying, looking at me strangely and saying, well, no, we don't have any used drum machines, but I can find you a really good drummer if you like. And he was making the point that he wasn't necessarily keen on technology replacing human beings. But certainly the technology that is used here does show the sort of journey, doesn't it, from, I suppose, something like drama and forward to 90125 with the amazing production techniques that he's really developing live here. And I did like that sort of thing. Some of the songs I found a little bit too much sort of chopped about with. They didn't flow and hang together as well as perhaps they could have done. Is that something you noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, that's where the whole realization of not having hits came to him, because the arrangements weren't as strong. I think that's also where Jeff kind of shines overall, is that he has a good sense of, you know, flow between parts. And his piano playing is very essential to that. The piano playing on this record, while good, it's just not up to the same caliber as if Jeff would have been on it. I mean, the songs that he's on there are evident, you know, I Am a Camera. I mean, like, listen to that piano playing, and that is fantastic. Right. And it's immediately signature to him, that reverberated piano, the kind of often the distant sound that he uses sometimes. It's just fantastic. And he, whenever he plays his piano in there, you can tell it has a smoothness to it, has a flow to it. And that's what makes those songs much more strong as a composition.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly one I want to have in my collection, though. And looking up here, you know, like the Bodast one. I mean, the Bodast stuff is great and really enjoyable. And this is great and really enjoyable. It's not an era-defining work, either of them, but certainly worth hearing. And, of course, we listened to the original release this week, because that's what we do, what we've tended to do on this segment. But the expanded version actually has some things which... interesting to see that they weren't included on this album. So we've got We Can Fly From Here, Parts 1 and 2, and Riding a Tide, which I'm reliably informed by my friends is actually the basis of Riding a Tiger from Fly From Here, the album. So would you have preferred those? Do you think they fitted? Maybe Fly From Here, We Can Fly From Here just wouldn't have fitted on this album.
I still think that would have been a good addition, but it just doesn't sound complete. Now, I don't know if that's because I'm so used to the version that is on the Yes album. It's very interesting. If I would have heard this record and heard those songs before the finished version. I mean, I kind of did, because when we got the Word Is Live box, Fly From Here was on there, but it was a live performance of it. And to me, live performances in the studio are very different, in my opinion. But you know, it still kind of sounded not fully realized. The same thing with Riding a Tide. I think that when I heard it, it's very much like the Yes version in composition and arrangement, but there's just something about it that just seems incomplete. It's like almost like when you listen to I Am a Camera on the record, with that whole 1, 2, 3, 4 count, and it almost seems like it's like a demo. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem like it's a full-fledged, you know, final product. And that's one of those things where I think that, you know, in his eyes, if I was Trevor Horn and I was doing a finished final record, I would have never have left that on there. I that's why I almost think that he approached this record more as a grand experiment for his production.
Yes. Now, which Yes song has got Steve Howe counting in? Going for the one, isn't it? Yes, that's right. Yeah. So interesting parallel there. Perhaps he did it in homage to that.
Yeah, maybe. But
I heard from Gary Andrews this week, which was great. He found his cassette versions of various things, including, as he says, my original cassette copy of Adventures in Modern Recording. I have no idea how many copies were produced, but even in 1983 in Morecambe, where he lives in the UK, or lived, it was impossible to get. I think I eventually found my cassette version in a charity shop around 1986. And I seem to remember it was pretty expensive for a second-hand item. He says, I did eventually buy the remastered CD in 2010, not sure which I prefer of the Buggles albums. And he continues, in regard to Chris Squire and effects, I couldn't hear what that was at all, incidentally, on the title track, I always assumed he was playing that repetitive chord with echo on the piano, similar to what he played on Drama when Trevor played bass. But now, he says, I'm not so sure. He goes on, the title track has that apparent live audience and a guitar bit, which I've always hoped was Steve Howe. Perhaps Chris was involved here. It's worth remembering that during this period, the early 80s, Chris contributed a great deal more to various projects than he was credited for. Esquire 90125, The Fairlight, work on Owner, Buggles, Adventures, etc. Trevor Horn tells that story where he and Chris basically put Owner together from Fairlight samples. So thanks very much indeed for those comments. So yeah, overall, I think it's a worthwhile addition to my collection of Yes and Yes related albums, and I will listen to it again. It reminds me very much of those early 80s times, and I suppose it's got 1 foot or half a foot stuck in the 80s there, in an unhelpful manner, but very much worth listening to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if anything, it's a fascinating look at the progress in the progression, actually, of Trevor Horn's skills as a producer. Because, I mean, from here, you know, we go on to, like, you know, big records, 90125 and, you know, all kinds of other things that he would do down the line. So it's interesting, even if just looking at it from that standpoint.
Yes, absolutely. Well worthwhile. Okay, brilliant stuff. So we've got through. Is this the 11th version of What Did They Do Next?
I can't believe it. The
revolving door has revolved 11 times by now. So I'll have to think about who comes next, but we'll go into that another time. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrein.
So Mark is still with me. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
And we have our two pence. So the statement this time is, Yes should play some virtual concerts instead of the live gigs that they've had to cancel or postpone. So initial thoughts on that idea, Mark?
I'm all for it. I actually love it. When this all started and a couple of my good friends posted, one of them being Mr. A.D. Adams, a shout out to Mr. A.D. Adams out there. He's from the Shabby Road Records Show podcast.
Yes.
And a fantastic drummer. And he was very upset about this whole coronavirus affecting him as a musician. He's a full-time musician and his livelihood is based on performance. And as we know, performances are being shut down. Now, when this first happened, I remember telling a few friends of mine online that if I had better equipment and, you know, an actual physical band that I could get together, I would do it myself. Yeah. Like, that was the first thought that came to my mind. It's like, go to a rehearsal studio with a couple of friends or even your basement and, you know, fire up a couple of cameras, hook it up to your computer and just do like little live performances for people to come out there and for people to log on and see. And I think it's a great idea. And if you remember, Billy Sherwood did it a few years back, I believe, was it with, which band was it with that he did that with? I'm trying to remember. But he did do an actual live stream broadcast.
Right.
Yeah, I believe it must have been Circa at that time. So I think they might have had an album that came out and they were doing a sort of like a promotional live gig on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it reminds me of several years ago now, our friend Ben Craven came onto the podcast and played with his band live, and I recorded it separately and then put it into the feed. And of course, Yes have done this previously, have they not? The simulcast that they did for Acoustic Live. Is that something that you enjoy, the Acoustic Live DVD?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. A few weeks ago, I actually pulled it out and watched it again, and I found it very, very interesting. Some fantastic variations of the songs. I think one of the things that I really liked on there was Rick Wakeman. I mean, obviously, like I've said 1,000 times before, his piano playing is just absolutely stellar. And
yes,
that's all he played on there was piano. Yes, so it was music to my ears.
Yes. It was great, wasn't it? And really enjoyed that. But interestingly, I always remember Steve Howe saying that he was more nervous before that simulcast than before any Yes concert that he could remember. So maybe that's one of the reasons why they wouldn't. But of course, in those days, the technology wasn't great. They had to simulcast. They couldn't have put it up onto the internet live at the time, or at least it would have been very difficult. So they had feeds going into cinemas. Around the US, I think, and that worked really rather well. But what I was thinking was, we're talking about the coronavirus situation, basically, and that's why the live concerts have been put off, at least for now. So what you're talking about is no need for an audience. So you have the guys there in a studio, as you say, just playing live. And what you would need, though, is a crew. And even the band members themselves, they would have to be in the same room. And maybe that's not sensible. So what about having them all in their own houses and joining up like that, which I know is technically really, really difficult. But could it be done?
I think there's way too much of a lag. I mean, as we experience here doing our own interviews sometimes via Skype,
yeah.
Sometimes you have like this 2-second delay between the question and the answer. And when you're playing music, that big a gap would just spell disaster in a performance, I think. I don't think that would be possible. But you know what? I a lot of different even sports are starting to take this approach to it as well. I'm a big fan of wrestling, as you might know. And one of the things that I've watched a lot now is a wrestling league called AEW. All Elite Wrestling, and they've been doing empty house shows. Like they've been going to arenas, and they were just completely empty, apart from just the wrestlers there.
Yeah,
and they were putting on full blown wrestling productions of their show to empty houses. Yeah. But you know, millions of people would watch it through television. So in a sense, it's the same thing, in my opinion. Why not just listen? You guys are, if the band themselves keep track with each other, they probably know each other's situation. Just get medically cleared. That you guys are all okay.
Yeah.
You know, hire a few people that you know as well within the crew, get them medically cleared as well, and then you're ready to go. You know what I mean? It isn't that, it really isn't that difficult. I mean, if, as long as you know that the people that are working with you are free of the virus,
yes,
then you can get together and do it. I mean, it's just for 1 day or 2 days or whatever. I mean, it's not like you're there together. And recently, I think on St. Patrick's Day, a band, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this band called the Dropkick Murphys, they just did a live broadcast as well, exactly what we're talking about from a club.
Okay, well, obviously it is technically possible. I wonder, logistically, is it possible, though, because you've got Downes and Howe in the UK. I suppose they would have to do it from the US because you've got Alan over there, Billy and Jay Shellen. So I suppose the two in over this side of the pond would have to go over. Are there even any flights? I don't know.
And the problem is too that the borders now are shut to non-residents now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I think logistically it would be really tricky. And I'm sure it was the right decision at the time. It would have been handy for us in our virtual scenario that we're painting here if Steve Howe and Jeff Downes had actually got to America and found themselves sort of stuck there, then perhaps it would have been possible. Go on.
But now that you kind of mentioned it, there's nothing stopping them, for example, to have Steve Howe do a separate acoustic performance from his home with one of his acoustic or classical, or to have Jeff put on a little piano thing for Yes fans. Yeah. I think they would love that. And even Alan White could do like a Memories of Yes, my memories from the Tales from Topographic Oceans tour for an hour. People would love that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? And it's going to be the way of the world, isn't it? That musicians, artists of all kinds have got to think more creatively about how they connect with their audiences if they can't get out live and connect with them in the same room.
Exactly. I mean, myself, I'm also trying to think of, little things to do to keep, my fan base interested. I'm sorry, I hate that word fan. Supporter base interested. Yeah. So, this kind of thing, I've even said it on my page too, is that while it's a very scary thing to be put in, But sometimes when you come out of this on the other side of it, sometimes it makes you do some changes that might be beneficial in the long run of stuff. Mm. So maybe thinking of these different scenarios and how to approach them might spawn some great idea in the future that we might all benefit from.
Yes, indeed. And I do hope that it doesn't curtail any work on, you know, this fabled album that we're going to be working on later on in the year. People have said that, you know, they should get together and do some serious work on the album now that they're not going to be touring. But, you know, that has the same difficulties, doesn't it, in terms of being in the same room with other people. But
not necessarily, because they can each do their parts at home and send their parts back and forth to a producer, let's say Billy Sherwood's producer. You know, they do the drums. Alan does it at his home residence, right?
Yeah.
They send the files over to Billy. He puts it on a master file on his Pro Tools at his place. You know, Billy lays down the bass track. Steve does his guitar at home, which he always seems to do anyways. He never wants to be in the same studio with the other guys anyways. So he just records his guitar stuff, sends it over to, you know what I mean? That seems a bit more feasible to do. If a time to do a record would be good, it would be now because of that.
Well, yeah, I agree. And certainly that's the way that Billy has worked many, many times with all sorts of different projects. And, you know, with the best will in the world, you have to say that the last time they were actually in the same building together in the same studio, it didn't go terribly well. So maybe it's time to try something different. And as you say, maybe that's one of the unintended consequences of this situation, is that you have to work in different ways and find ways of actually working together like that. So maybe that's interesting. Now, interestingly, also, just as I was writing the notes for this Two Pence, I had a message from Daniel Crone, and he was thinking exactly the same thing. So at the same time, across the world, he and I were both thinking, I wonder if they could do a virtual type concert. So if you go onto the Yes Music Podcast page, you'll see that he's been a lot more elaborate with it. He's actually taken the time to think about what set list they could have done had they been able to do a virtual concert, and whether you would have wanted them to play the Relayer set or something different. So go over to that and add your comments to that. And of course, add your comments to the show notes for this week. What do you think about this idea of doing something virtually, maybe not a concert, as we've just been discussing? So maybe one or two of the members of Yes doing different kinds of live virtual events. Is that something you'd be interested in going to? I'm sure it is. Is it something that you would even pay for? Well, let us know your ideas. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Miguel Falcón at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Established in 2011, this is Two Pence's exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band.
Just before we go, here's the Patreon update, or half of it. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Scott, Steve Rode, Steve Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, and Bill Hayes. Continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in helping to support the show financially and having access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week, coronavirus permitting. But in the meantime, do follow the show on Instagram, on Facebook, or on Twitter. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.